Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to the Daily Fringe Show. We are back for 2022. It really does feel like we're in the future, and we're very happy to be back, or at least I am, and I assume my colleagues are. I'm, of course, joined today by Ms. Saragon. Sara, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm all full of the joys of the greenery that I've encountered on my holidays, and I am very pleased to be back.
Excellent. And also, Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, I know you had a busy holiday, not really a holiday. How was it? How are you? How are things? How's your new year?
Very good. Snovom Gordom. That's the Russian way of greeting on the new year. It means with the new year. Can't force people to be happy. Can't tell them to be happy. You can just say whatever's happening, it's happening with the new year. And so maybe you can choose to be happy or not. It's up to you. I'm going to hold myself back from making jokes about greenery pursued in the holidays. Sara and I maybe have a different. Never mind that. I had a good time. Did a bit of the Wild Coast. A little bit of work. Some media around Tutu's death, and quite a lot around the Command Council, the state of disaster, and the expropriation without compensation amendment to the Constitution. Which was defeated, basically, until a new parliament is formed. I just don't see a way for the constitution to be amended to allow that. That doesn't mean the issue isn't over, but it does mean that we finished the year with another great triumph. And I think, 2021 turned out to be a year with some surprisingly big wins. We had an election which we fought for at the court, and we had parliament doing the right thing in striking down the amendment to the
and there was the amendment to the Firearms Control Act that was withdrawn as well. So that was another big achievement for the IRR and all of our friends in that sphere.
Thank you very much to Nicholas, who wrote a very excellent report on don't add co-wrote. Disorder to chaos. Report on the firearms issue.
I traveled to Sutherland, which is a lovely town in the Northern Cape, in the Southern Northern Cape. And I had an absolutely great time there. And I'm even thinking maybe I should move there because it was just much nicer than Joburg, despite how difficult the weather is. When we were there, it's very hot. And someone there was telling me about how often they have to replace pipes because they freeze and burst in the winter because it's so cold. Anyway,
It snows travel there, right? It snows in the desert.
It snows a couple of times. It makes these really great photos, which you can check out if you search for Sutherland in winter, I think, online. And I got to travel through a bit of the country, did most of the N1, traveled most of the country in one day, and it's not looking so great out there. There's a couple of nice spots here or there, but generally a lot of South Africa's towns are not looking so good out there. Like I say, some exceptions, but man, there's some not so great, not very happy looking towns right now. A lot of people sitting in the sunshine, kind of looking a bit listless, which is not great. Anyway, so what happened during the time that we were away on the Daily Fringe? Well, as Gabriel just mentioned, we had, of course, the EWC constitutional amendment, which we'll discuss in more detail shortly. We also had, of course, the Zondo Commission come out. We had Archbishop Desmond Tutu die. And, of course, we had Parliament burned down, which we will also get to later. So let's start off with the constitutional amendment thing. So, Gabriel, I kind of said something along these lines when I heard that the EFF and ANC would not get to play nicely together on the constitutional amendment, this was the country stepping back from the brink of a national suicide. Is that right? What should we make of the defeat of the constitutional amendment?
Stepping back from the brink of a national suicide is a good, that seems like a good way to think about it. I'm a bit of a gloomy chap sometimes. I think because our prospects in this regard are quite gloomy. So let me give you another metaphor. It's like someone who is about to shoot his head off with a gun in the right hand, who then put the gun in the left hand. So the reason that happened is that...
And here I was hoping for a good news story.
Well, it is good news. It's very good news that the constitutional amendment was defeated, because it means that if some kind of expropriation without compensation is achieved and it is then challenged in the court, we have the original language of our founding constitution, of our Bill of Rights, to act as a shield against that attempt. Now, that shield is made out of language that's going to be interpreted by justices. And justices can interpret things all kinds of ways, as it turns out, even if it's quite straightforward how it's written. There's no accounting for human ingenuity when it comes to reinterpretation. So it's not perfect, but we have to fight. And we've built public pressure. The biggest thing about this win is that it has shown, not only as our surveys do, that the vast majority of ordinary South Africans are not into this. 80% of South Africans basically get that this is crazy, that promising something for nothing is the last word in incredibility, and that you shouldn't trust people who do that. Okay, that's ordinary South Africans. What about the powerful South Africans? Well, it turns out even the powerful South Africans sitting in parliament when they can actually sit and when it's not burnt down, they also get it that this is a crazy idea and they scupper it. They come up with funny stories about why they're doing that. The EFF wants to nationalize all land. The ANC just wants to nationalize certain land. This doesn't strike me as a very considered difference. If the EFF was very serious about achieving its policy goal, it would have voted with the ANC to get this, and then it would later have pushed even further to nationalize all land. I think they both have shown that they can't really get behind this issue when the rubber hits the road, that it's an easy symbolic theatrical thing to rip your clothes and beat your breast about the horrors are very real of the last 100 years. But when you try and solve it by adding the same kind of problem on top of the problem, people get that it's crazy. Here's why I say it's nevertheless like taking the gun from one hand to the other. The expropriation bill is still en route. That bill would achieve expropriation without compensation with similarly vague terms for, you know, these and those scenarios, but any other scenario that someone can think of. And that someone will turn out to be a land court. The land courts bill is coming through, which would basically allow hearsay evidence to become respected by the courts as proper evidence. It would allow not persona ficta or legal persons to act both as evidence givers and in a kind of consulting capacity, which really, look, collective responsibility. If you think it's a great idea, go check out how the ANC's track record has been for the last 10 years. It's even worse if you try and apply that in a court in terms of giving evidence. So that combination would achieve the kind of kangaroo court EWC at a grassroots municipal level nightmare that I think we've worried about quite a lot. And because some people will feel complacent because we've won the battle, there's a chance that we sort of zombie walk our way into just putting the gun from one hand to another and pulling the trigger. So that is going to be a huge fight for us. It is an important win because we've shown the public pressure issue because we've held onto the original language of the Constitution. The left hand is more clumsy. It might not be able to find the trigger, but we're going to have to wrestle with it to put that gun away.
I think that's exactly right. So, yeah, indeed, this is a battle won in a war not yet over. Sarah, what do you have to add to what Gabriel was saying?
Yeah.
What do you make of the EFF? What do you make of all this?
I wonder whether what motivated the ultimate collapse in Parliament wasn't the fact that it was better in the long run not to amend the Constitution, because amending the Bill of Rights in the Constitution, which has never been done before, is a very big deal. It would attract the sort of international opprobrium that it well deserves. And so I can't help wondering if they kind of let it go because they've got the expropriation bill waiting in the wings, which can be nasty, as destructive as Gabriel has alluded to. And you know, it was always launched for nefarious political reasons, because the ANC has always hung the supposed failure of land reform onto it, when in fact the one need not have anything to do with the other. But I certainly think they will try with the expropriation bill. It's more innocuous because the bill does reflect changes that had to be made. It was an old act, and therefore didn't reflect constitutionally correctly under the new constitution. So it needed some changing anyway. But it's provided the scope to really leave the landowner in an invidious position, both as Gabriel said, with referring to the nature of evidence, the fact that the land essentially can be taken by a municipality and the owner is then left to fight a fight they can't afford, and by the time they've finished, they'll have given up. So I think if it's dastardly deeds are still to be done.
Right, so the expropriation bill is a bit like a kitchen that maybe needs some touching up, and the government has decided that instead of touching up the kitchen, they're going to knock out one of the walls and build a whole new rental strip apartment club. Space. Yeah, strip club.
They're going to install a brothel.
They've done that before.
Security agency money. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's the best kind of money. Gabriel, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
Yeah, so just my fiance is doing her PhD in philosophy at Pittsburgh University, which is kind of the school of Pittsburgh philosophy is really about pragmatism. It's a technical thing. How do you explain it? Well, the thought is that a lot of philosophy is about making explicit that which is implicit. So there's a funny phrase, right? I won't get into the technical details. The thought is like language. We already know how to use language. We know how to use past tense, and someone then makes it explicit what the rules are. And it turns out, oh, we've been operating according to those rules all along. So I feel like I spend a lot of my time with people talking about making explicit that which is implicit. And that, unfortunately, has become a very standard South African line for expropriation without compensation. They say it's implicit in the Constitution that you, as the state, can abuse a puny citizen. That instead of getting taxpayers to pay for public goods, like if you have some public good in terms of land reform, helping out emerging farmers, black farmers that have been deprived, redressing people whose land was directly stolen, instead of having taxpayers collectively pay for the public goods, just like they pay for other public goods, you find one person and you punish that person, even though that person committed no crime. They say that's implicit in our constitution. Now, the short thing to say is that is not implicit in our constitution. It is explicitly prevented in our constitution. But that has been a line that has been said so many times that I think some people believe it in the way that people do when they just hear the same thing over and over and over again. And that's going to be part of the fight is making it very clear. And I don't think it'll be too hard. That the Constitution does not implicitly allow the state to abuse citizens. And we campaigned against citizen abuse before. We'll keep it up.
I think the expropriation bill, as opposed to the constitutional amendment, is much more in keeping in line with the ANC's more successful periods of its sort of strategic operation of pushing ideology kind of a little bit more under the carpet, not so blatantly, because when you do it really out in the open, like mucking with the Constitution, everyone kind of sits up and goes, wait a minute, hold on, what's this? But when you do it, oh, it's just an updating of the law. It's like, yeah, so calm down.
If I can say one last thing, it's like Zimbabwe did it in the stupidest way, where you just have chaotic people stealing stuff. Venezuela did it in the slightly smarter way, where they had a constitutional amendment, but they said it's only for very limited amounts of land. And South Africa is now next leveling, where it's like, no, we're not even going to change the Constitution. We're just going to read it into the Constitution. We're going to find it between the lines in the Constitution.
Yeah. So it's definitely something that we're going to keep fighting, but still very good that we did have a win on this, because it is, even if you get a new government, once the Constitution's been changed in a stupid way like that, it can be very difficult to roll back the damage. So very good news. Anyway, let us move on to our next story. And this is the devastating fire that tore through the Houses of Parliament, because we do actually have, I think, two Houses of Parliament or three, the National Council of Provinces. We've got the National Assembly Chamber, which is the big one where we hold our normal Parliament sitting. And then we also have the old Parliament Chamber, which is often used for debates and that kind of stuff. It's not the main seating hall for Parliament. Anyway, both the old and the National Assembly Chamber got devastated by a huge fire during the holidays while no one was there. And there are lots of questions that have been raised about this fire. Apparently the sprinkler system didn't work. and hadn't been working for several years. Apparently, the fire doors that existed were just sort of held open with latches. Apparently, the security cameras, which are supposed to be manned at all times by the police, who have the responsibility to protect Parliament, as it is a national key point, and therefore is under sort of proper security, weren't watching. Apparently, the fire alarm didn't go off. And so as a result, the fire got really bad before anyone noticed, and firefighters struggled for a very long time to put the fire out. In fact, they struggled so much that even once they thought they had gotten it under control, there was a big gust of Cape wind and it restarted the fire for a bit. So it's never a good thing when one's parliament burns down. You can ask Germany in the 30s. It didn't go so well for them. But Sarah, I don't know. The circumstances of this are very weird because, of course, someone has been arrested. It does appear that it is arson. At least that's the line from the police. A guy called Zandile Mafe, who I believe is a homeless man, has been
Zandile
arrested.
Zandile Christmas Mafe.
Oh, yes. He's currently undergoing a 30-day evaluation to ascertain whether he's fit to stand trial, whether he's too mentally ill. Very strange circumstances, this whole fire business. Is this, you know, some sort of dark conspiracy, or is this really just a combination of incompetent state plus random madman?
It could be dark conspiracy with a random madman being assisted by a failure to keep up your resources and your doors closed and your fire alarms working, et cetera, et cetera. I think the bottom line is who knows. I think that, you know, interestingly, the EFF was distinctly pleased about the destruction. They thought, you know, the colonial edifice, you know, is coming down. And so it suited, you know, their narrative very, very well. You have the so-called homeless man who is alleged so-called to have been some sort of insurgent of sorts. And then you have the attorney acting for him, looking like very quickly the guy's got an attorney. He does not have to apply for a state attorney. He's got this attorney, very slick-looking gentleman. It doesn't look like he does much pro bono work. And he's argued in court for just prior to being committed to Valkenburg by advocate Darlene Porfu. So the whole it's a metaphor for the country. It's skullduggerous, it's weird, it's strange, it's unlikely, it's very likely. But probably the worst about it are those elements of incompetence, failed maintenance, which is a very South African government thing. It appears so much now in towns, in cities. So the failure to provide the sort of maintenance and care that should go with a building like that is in itself criminal. The president doesn't think that the president doesn't seem to be holding anyone particularly responsible for it. But I've got to say, I think the most extraordinary moment of the fire is on the day that the fire was still blazing. President Ramaphosa went to Parliament and he was interviewed, and he was praising the work of the fire brigades and saying, you see, at least these things work. I know that sometimes people think that we are just falling apart or words to that effect, but here in this place, things work.
I think he said at least we have a city and a province that works.
In other words, there is the president of the ANC showering praise upon the competence of the DA, city council, and provincial government. It was... I mean, he was basically talking the truth, but coming from there where it was, I think it was the drama of the moment, it would probably be put down.
Yeah, I think he was trying to make a broader point about how, you know, government works better than people think or something like that in general.
Yeah, anybody else's government works better than people think. But I think for me, whatever someone may have tried to do, whether it was by accident or deliberately, the complete lack of oversight, police involvement, doors closed, all those practical things that should help to minimize the destruction of fire were not in place. I mean, you know, if that's the situation, you can probably pretty much you know, light a match to a dried plant and the place would go up. So it's, that's a disgrace. Whatever may end up being the reason why the fire was lit in the first place.
So I saw the ANC had quite a schizophrenic. So as you say, the EFF was extremely, you know, clear about how it felt about the fire, reacting sort of pretty much with glee. And the ANC was sort of a bit confused because on one hand, it sort of said, no, we're not interested at all in moving Parliament to Pretoria, which is a thing I think the EFF is very keen on. And some in the ANC have been muttering about for a while, which is, of course, presumably the reason that anyone would burn down if there was some grand conspiracy, burn down Parliament. So the ANC, I think, initially released a statement, no, we're not interested in this. And also the DA, by offering us the City Council of Cape Town to do the State of the Nation, is being evil and opportunistic. And then they released a second statement saying, much nicer to the city, saying, oh, you know, it's one thing we'll consider. And maybe we will consider moving it to Pretoria. I don't know. It was very strange because the ANC didn't seem to be able to know how to respond to this. And maybe different factions in the caucus were releasing different statements. Who knows? But Gabriel, what do you make of all this? It is a very strange event, I think, in our political history, and maybe one that we will look back on with a little bit more insight. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I was in Parliament. It made me think back to my lonely visit on business to Parliament, which was for the IRR, to accompany Advocate Martin Brassey to go to that old chamber and argue that amending the constitution to allow expropriation without compensation is a terrible idea. And that expropriation without compensation in general is a terrible idea and is banned, barred, and prohibited by our constitution. I was struck by how beautiful that old chamber was. And I think it is irreplicable. The wood, deep, good old wood, the green leather. The new chamber is also quite interesting. It's sort of redone, I don't know when. It's always seemed a bit more chintzy to me. The old chamber really seemed like a magnificent place to be. Now, I noticed at the time, I mean, sort of chain smoking in the courtyard. You could see that everyone was going through the fire doors, that it wasn't very well kept. And I spoke to a member of Parliament who complained quite bitterly about how, I mean, the area around there is really nice. It's shocking as a South African. I was staying in a hotel right close to Parliament, and I could walk there after sunset. But this is like a central business district kind of environment where you feel completely safe. And people are telling you it's totally safe, and you can see single women, young and old, walking around, which I don't see having lived in Heelbrow and Doornfontein and Yeovil in central Johannesburg. So they're saying how central Cape Town really is quite nice and well protected, and there's lots of effort that's gone into that. And then when you get into Parliament, there's a bit of a mix up because it is actually the jurisdiction of like the speaker and those national competencies, and that they feel worried. I remember this expression of like, you know, I worry that something bad is going to happen here because it's not being well tended. That turned out to be super prescient. And I think that speaks to the point that Sara was making. We don't know so much, but what we do know is that this was way too easy. Now, in terms of why did it happen? I have no idea. And this is not what happened, but I'm just going to say it because I think it's an interesting thing to think about. The predominant theory is that this Christmas is too crazy to have done it alone, and that he's being used as a scapegoat. Now, it's very interesting that this idea of the scapegoat, we've been working so hard at this inside at the IRR. You know, don't scapegoat Ace Magashule. Don't scapegoat Jacob Zuma. Don't scapegoat one politician. One politician did not steal all the money. One politician did not make unemployment get to effectively, you know, 50% for youth and more. There's a systemic issue here. And we would struggle to get the idea of a scapegoat to go viral. Now, everyone I know is talking about a scapegoat. The guys at the petrol station, they were like, I live in a little gated community. They're like, your security is better than that security. And they're just using that guy as a scapegoat. This has come just at the same time as the Zondo Commission. Maybe someone really hates the ANC, really hates the idea of one scapegoat falling for the whole party, and has now put this person up to a thing or scapegoated them so that it would go viral, that you mustn't slaughter the scapegoat and forgive the bad system. You must address the bad system. Now, that's crazy. That can't be what happened. But it's a nice way to think about it, I think, because scapegoating is such a dangerous psychological shortcut to genuine accountability.
So I think we will see more come out about this in the coming weeks. I'm sure there's more of a story to be uncovered here. But we don't have a lot of time, so let's move very quickly to the story that's dominating the rest of the news outside of the Daily Friend, and that is the Zondo Commission, which I think they did look for an extension to February sometime in December. And then obviously someone said, guys, come on.
So now it's coming out in parts.
Yes, finally, we have the Zondo Commission report, or at least some of it. And, well, you know, sorry, you were just saying beforehand. Not that shocking, but also very interesting reading.
Well, obviously, we can't discuss 856 pages of a report. And it's written like a judgment. So it's paragraph by paragraph numbered, setting out the evidence to the range of allegations. And for the past 5, 6, 7 years, we've seen and read and heard about that information that's come out of the mainstream media, the Amar Burghani's Daily Maverick, etc. So for those who sort of just keep a little bit up to date with the media, there's not really anything one doesn't know about. The only thing about reading through this stuff, and here they were dealing with Dudu Mieni's term in the South African Airways, the sale of the New Age newspaper, the Guptas, to South African Airways, to Eskom and to Transnet, and then the Finucane that went along that. But in the sort of dry, ongoing detail, you get a very strong sense of how the people are as bad as you think they are, but how bad they really were, what a dreadful human being Dudu Mieni actually was. I mean, she sat on the board of the SAA, to give you an example, under Cheryl Carolus's term as chair. She was considered useless. She never attended a meeting to finality, often didn't attend at all, and would leave a meeting saying, I've got to go and have a meeting with number one. And then essentially what Malusi Gigaba, the relevant minister, does is, after alienating the Carolus board, eventually most of them resign, he appoints Mieni. So it is so clearly under the auspices of the then president, Jacob Zuma. It's that sense of, it's almost just a bit sort of highlighted rather than producing anything new. It gives a sort of glow to it and a largeness that is rather, it just confirms our worst fears. And the fact that a great deal of the evidence presented, some of which was very thorough and very damning, was either answered by sort of the accused parties badly, or in the case of Dudu Mieni, not answered at all. People didn't come forward, ignored summonses, etc. And it's clear why, because to try, if given the fact that the evidence one read looked credible and it was supported by other people, no wonder Jacob Zuma threw his toys out of the cot. He couldn't have answered those questions. He would have had to obfuscate or deny or apply for the the First Amendment? That's an American thing. But anything not to say anything. Okay. Because it really, really looked terrible. But you get that enormous sense all the way through. And, of course, there are instances where he communicates directly with people who ultimately are fired for not doing his bidding. And the links between him and the Guptas comes up really quite frequently. So he can pretend to be the misunderstood scapegoat of the ANC, but he set the rot in motion, there's no doubt, and that's what comes out.
So, Gabriel, we will return to this topic, so don't feel the need to get all your points in now, but in about 60 seconds or so, your thoughts on initially looking at the Zondo report.
Yeah, so to me, much more interesting than Dudu Mieni has been Yake Kwanini, who we saw at the Zondo Commission procurement officer The evidence laid out against her is very interesting and damning. Very interesting how when she gets in a hole, she says, look, I was doing this for BEE, so it must be fine. And the most interesting thing, the single most important thing, in my opinion, about part one of the Zondo Commission report is this. It damns BEE. You have to get all the way to the end. But it says, Section 217 of the Constitution has two provisions. The one is that procurement must be cheap and efficient and transparent and fair. And the other is that that shouldn't get in the way of affirmative action if that's what you're in for. It has gotten in the way. And it's unfortunate that the law is as it is and it must change, because it must be clear that it's not an either or, that the first provision is a must. The second one is a only afterwards. If you've got two exactly equal, can you get to this? But the first is a must, and that is not how things are in our law today. It's a systemic analysis that Zondo offers in clear language, but right at the end, and I haven't heard anyone talk about it. It's very important.
Very good point, sir, and we will certainly return to that. Anyway, we hope you enjoyed our first show of the year. We look forward to serving you news, analysis, opinion, all that good stuff for the rest of the year. And yeah, thank you very much for watching. Please spread the good word, and we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.